Greetings all, welcome to this week's episode of Examining X-Men 97 as we discuss the newly released third episode of the series entitled Fire Made Flesh. I'm your regular co-host, the extremely tired but extremely excited Max Byrne, and I'm joined as ever by the other regular co-host, the extraordinary, exceptional, and some might say exquisite Spider-Dan. Here he is. How are you, sir?
I'm very good. Thank you for, again, wonderful intro, as I expect from you, Max, as well. And exceptional as well. Again, extraordinary, as you so wonderfully put it yourself. Again, we're back. So we've just got a single episode this week, for better or for worse. We had such a good time looking at those first two, and the whole world has been lit on fire, and everybody has an opinion on it, and people have been complaining and loving and, you know, binging. It's one of the, I think it had 4 million views on its first day, I believe, those first two episodes. So, and it's very rare that streaming services will give you those kind of numbers unless they're really good numbers. And again, the reviews have been great. I'm loving it. A lot of people are loving it. It's pissing off the right people or the wrong people, whatever you want to call them, the bigots and of the world. And yeah, I'm all here for it. So I'm back on the train, and I'm really excited to talk about this next one.
Yeah, me too. Yeah, suddenly everyone in the world's an X-Men expert. Who knew?
I know. I know, right?
Who knew?
I loved X-Men. X-Men was my favorite. Yeah, of course it is. Everyone's back on the fucking bandwagon when they want to be. Not during the bad stuff, not during the shit shows and stuff, but they're all back on the bandwagon now. But again, the more the merrier. Again, it's not...
Oh, yeah.
I'm one of those things. I'm not a gatekeeper in any sense, but I do like having a kind of a niche, you know, a niche thing that not many people are into or have kind of fallen off of. And to be fair, I fell off X-Men as well a little bit. So, but no, I'm absolutely back on board 100%.
Yeah, me too. Yeah, I think it's reinvigorated a lot of people's love for the franchise, but the group and the characters and everything, and more, you know, more power to them, I suppose. You know, it's thrown on bigger spotlight, you know, it's heightened awareness. It means when and if we eventually get them in live action, the interest is going to be magnified tenfold because of this series. So, you know, everyone's a winner, I guess, aren't they?
And maybe this will be the template for the new one. This is what they'll kind of revert back to. Or maybe they'll do something completely different. Maybe they'll do like the original X-Men. Maybe it'll just be the five teenagers, you know, who knows? Whatever they decide to do, or however they decide to do it, I'm sure we'll find out. But I'm not really thinking about that. I don't want to think about that because I'm thinking about X-Men 97. This is what I'm here for. This is what we're here to talk about yet again. But yeah, what an episode. Fire Made Flesh. Since you did the intro, shall I give us a synopsis?
Yeah, tell us what it was about.
Yeah, of course. So at the end of the last episode, we learned that there are two Jean Greys, finally, one for Wolverine and one for Cyclops. And they can share the wealth, the bountiful wealth of the busty, fiery, very fiery redheads in this episode. I know that's a stereotype, but yes, we went there because it's the Inferno episode, which we kind of had some inklings that this may be leading towards. We get, again, spoilers for this episode before we get into it, but we have a lot of links to that storyline. Not quite that storyline, but we'll get into it and the differences they've made. And it's kind of condensed and streamlined, and it works for what they're trying to do within this episode and what they're trying to say. But we learn that the one who has been with the X-Men and has been trying to get away from the team as much as possible, turns out to be a clone. And she's had the baby, but she is not the original. Jean Doe, as Morph humorously calls her originally. She is completely, she has no identity. She doesn't know who she is, but this other Jean does. She has everything. And it's the Spider-Man clone saga, isn't it? It's like, which one's real? Which one is the original? Is it this one? Is it not? Who cares? When did they switch? When were they replaced? You know, it's that kind of, they're playing with that idea. And, you know, and that's for another podcast for me and Tony to talk about, really. But yeah, so we learn that. And then she is, the clone is revealed to be manipulated by and created by Mr. Sinister in order to produce a genetic offspring that he can use to create new and more powerful mutants for his superior world of genetic engineering that he wants, the mad scientist that he is, the Victorian mad scientist he is. And the X-Men are then pit against the Goblin Queen, as she now calls herself, which kind of doesn't entirely make sense in this version of the, with this version of the character. But again, we'll get into that. And Nathan is kidnapped, and not only do all the X-Men have to go out, but Jean and Jean have to team up to stop Mr. Sinister. And something very, well, a lot of bad things happen to the characters in this episode because it is very horror-themed and dark, and they just send into the bowels of hell to find the wee bairn that is Nathan Summers. But yeah, that is basically the episode. And yeah, it's a very interesting, very different from the episodes we've already had, but I like that.
Yeah, me too. It was a change of pace, wasn't it? The first one was very action-packed. The second one was kind of sort of more of a rumination on sort of what it means to be mutant, albeit with some great action at the end. Whereas this one is a bit more of a cerebral episode. The stuff that goes on, the action is, apart from, again, we'll get to it later, but the confrontation in Sinister's lab, but the before that, it's more a sort of theater of the mind confrontation, yes, isn't it, with these wonderful visions and what have you. So I really enjoyed it. I thought it really did play to the strengths. Was it a perfect 30 minutes or 32 minutes of television? No, but you know, again, it's very minor things, isn't it, that you want to sort of say, oh, this and that. But I thought it was really great. I love the fact that the ambiguity as well there, but you know, starting at the very beginning there, the clone Jean doesn't know she's a clone at this point anyway. She's no idea. And the fact that they share all the memories of each other means that you can't differentiate between the two. I mean, without jumping ahead, there's a bit at the end when they go, when they're sort of saying their goodbyes, go, well, we don't know when we were even swapped, you know, which one of us became Dark Phoenix. We don't know, you know, we'll never know maybe. So I like that. There's that real ambiguity and you're left guessing, you know, you think, wow, during the course of the original five seasons, was there a point? Was there a point, any point there where that could have happened? You know, were the clues there and we didn't know? Or, you know, has it been retconned as such that if you watch it back, there might be something that points out? There's a lot to think about there, isn't there?
There is, yeah. And you could try and work it out and try and think about who it was. I saw a lot of memes going around that the one at the door was Jean Grey because she fainted, and she was known for fainting in the show quite a bit. So they were like, oh, she's the real one, definitely. Straight away, people were like that. And they were right, funnily enough. So yeah, I think I need to explain who Madeline Pryor is, because, as I said, we saw a toy earlier on. I teased that in the previous episodes that I kind of knew where this was going to a degree, not this specific episode, until they teased it at the end of the previous one. But Madeline Pryor, this is going to take me a while to explain, Max, so hold on to your...
strap in, everyone.
Here we go. X-Men continuity. Here we go. The Dark Phoenix saga. Jean is consumed by the Phoenix entity, and she is worried that she's going to kill millions more alien lives or lives within the universe that she's already done, and she decides to sacrifice and kill herself to save the universe from her own, you know, needs and desires that the Phoenix has instilled in her. Okay. One. So after that, Scott is obviously heartbroken, in you know, in bits, can't live his life, depressed. He meets a lovely redhead who looks very similar to Jean while he's finally meeting his grandparents and his dad again, the space pirate Corsair. That's a whole nother story to get into. but he meets her and he's like, and he falls in love with her head over heels. She's not like Jean. She's very similar in a lot of ways, but she's not Jean. And Mastermind, all the while behind this, is trying to convince Scott that she's the reincarnation of Jean, because the Phoenix legend is about resurrection. So he's trying to manipulate, because she sent him insane and now he's come back and he wants his revenge on the X-Men and is using her. And then he... convinces the X-Men that Scott is actually the Phoenix and they're attacking him as the Phoenix. They stop him. Everything's worked out. Madeline is upset because he approaches her and goes, "You must be Jean. You're definitely Jean." They get married at the end of the end of that storyline. They have a child. Scott leaves the X-Men after battling with Storm, and she takes over as leader. And you know, everything's great until Marvel Studios or Marvel Comics said, "We want to bring back Jean. Let's bring back Jean." Chris Claremont said, who was the writer who killed off Jean, he said, "We cannot bring Jean back. The only way we can bring Jean back is if we make her not responsible for all those lives that she snuffed out on that alien planet." I think it was Dabari, I think it was called, if I remember rightly, because she basically ate her son and the neighboring planets died. And that was his stipulation, the only way you can bring him back. So John Byrne, and I think I want to say it was Mark Gruenwald or Roger Stern, one of the kind of writers in the early 80s, they came up with the idea that the Phoenix had created her own body based on Jean using her DNA. So the Phoenix who had died was a kind of a replicant body that she made, and she started to believe she was Jean. It was that convincing to her, the Phoenix.
Yeah.
We find Jean, the Avengers and the Fantastic Four find Jean in a cocoon at the bottom of Jamaica Bay, which is what the Phoenix put her in at the time. And the probes that they are using, because they don't know what's inside, they have no idea. It's just this magic cocoon that's happening. They open it up. Unfortunately, because of the probing, it affects Jean's telepathic abilities. She loses those. She's only got telekinetic abilities. Scott learns of this, abandons his wife and child, runs off to Jean, and again, the original X-Men form X-Factor, which I talked about before, which they masquerade as hunters of mutants, and they, you know, just form a new kind of team. And eventually they drop the idea of the masquerading as just another kind of superhero X-Men team. Okay. Madeline, broken-hearted, runs off with the X-Men because she feels she needs protection, she needs help, and she joins them, and she has a kind of a love affair a little bit with Havoc, only to then kind of all of this frustration and anger, what we see in this show, we see that she gets seduced by Sim and Limbo, which was kind of introduced in the Magic miniseries with Storm as well, which I covered on my own podcast. I'll link that in the show notes because she has a big role, and she even makes an appearance in this episode, Ilyana Rasputin, because of the links to that storyline. So she then becomes this goblin queen, this kind of sorceress who runs the Limbo dimension, only to learn during the Inferno crossover, which has a demon invasion happening to New York and goes across all the titles. During this, we learn that Sinister created her because he needed to create a child with the genetic potential to destroy Apocalypse, who created him. So he needed to create the ultimate mutant to destroy him. And that was his idea, but he couldn't do that because Jean was dead. So that's why he cloned her. And he named her Madeline Pryor because she was prior to existing. And what she does is she kind of goes mad and is trying to take over. Again, there's a lot more going on, but in a nutshell, there's a demon invasion. She's trying to take over. Jean confronts her. They have a massive battle. Madeline Pryor dies, and Jean absorbs her memories and her psyche into herself and becomes kind of whole again with the Phoenix and all the other different aspects of Jean all combined into one, and she gets her telepathic powers back. And then Madeline would then turn up several other times. She would become a villain of like X-Man and turn up in like Cable and stuff, because she is the mother of Cable, technically, not Jean. But in a nutshell, that is Madeline Pryor. But again, they kind of condense that and kind of do a slightly different take of that idea here. But yes, in the comics, she was a literal goblin queen. Here, not so much.
Yeah. Well, bravo for that. I hope everyone was listening out there, because that was the most thorough yet succinct character biography you could ever have to listen to. That was absolutely brilliant, Dan. Thank you.
Oh, awesome. Thank you. Thank you, Max. I'm glad you put up with that, because I don't know how succinct it actually was, but thank you.
No, it was ace. And for any of you old folk rockers out there, apparently Chris Claremont named after Maddie Pryor, the lead singer of Steel Eye Span.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, yeah, very famous British folk rock band, who I think are still going, actually. They've been around since the 60s, a couple of big hits. But the lead singer is Maddie Pryor, and apparently, anyway, Claremont is or was a fan of Steel Ice Band, and that's where she came from.
Wow. So
there is a folk rock female vocalist legend out there who...
Did you say it was a heavy metal? Did you say it was a heavy metal band?
No, not at all. It's like folk rock, that kind of thing. Yeah, not my thing at all, to be honest with you. Yeah. But
I thought heavy metal would be appropriate because it gets very kind of satanic, like a lot of this sort of stuff within what we're exploring. Like I was talking to my friend Nathan about this and how it's like, oh, we're bringing this back for kids, and I'm like, is it for kids? This, like, I don't think it is. I'm slowly starting to think that this is. I think kids can watch it and enjoy it, don't get me wrong, but I don't think, why would these kids playing Fortnite every single day of their lives, my nephew included.
Yeah. My son included.
Yeah, there you go, exactly. Why would they care about a 30-year-old cartoon that's come back? So part of me is thinking this is not really for kids. I think it's there for kids if they want it. I think it's got a lot of adult mature content for mature kids or teenagers or 20-year-olds. But I actually starting to think it's more for the 30-year-old fans or older.
Well, this 40 or 4-year-old quite likes it, you know. I agree. You know, there's certainly in this episode as well, you know, some of the hellish visions and things like that, a little bit unsettling. You think if I was showing this to my son who's 9 or a younger child, I might have second thoughts about it. Yeah. You know, and Madeline Pryor's outfit as well is very, very 80s metal. It is very much like you'd kind of see a cavorting at the back of a Wasp video or something like that. It's true to the comic book image of the character, though. That's how she's been depicted.
Like the Mark Silvestri was drawing X-Men at the time, and I remember his artwork and her. But in his outfit, they give her this kind of like underboob thing, and I see a lot of like cosplayers really struggling with the designs of these kind of characters that have these underboob designs. And I'm like, the only thing that was keeping those babies up was her telekinetic powers, I think, at that point. But I think I prefer this design because it's not quite as maybe male gazy, maybe a little too like creepy and weird, but also I think it harkens back to the Black Queen of the Hellfire Club during the Dark Phoenix saga as well. That outfit especially is a bit more in line with this, but yeah, I really like the design though. I thought it was an epic design. I love how she just looks completely different when she becomes this demonic persona, the Goblin Queen.
Yeah, I think so. I think it straddles the right line of being tasteful and not being too gratuitous, you know, everything on show and what have you. I think it is, you know, it's just about on the right side. But speaking of that transformation, then we get this scene with her sort of in the nursery holding Nathan, and this mysterious voice comes through the baby monitor, belonging to, of course, none other than Mr. Sinister. But what a wonderfully sort of overblown, wonderfully arch kind of delivery he has in it. It is literally like larger. There's nothing subtle about this villainy or this depiction of a character that's not very subtle, to be honest.
Yeah.
But this, you know, he's not a Machiavellian villain in the shadows or anything. He's a larger than life, operatic, theatrical, Victorian villain, isn't he? And their voice is spot on, I think. For a while, the voice is all you get in this episode through the monitor before he eventually sort of appears out the corner. But it is like so OTT, but it works, doesn't it?
Yeah, yeah. And that's what I want from Mr. Sinister. I want that he's kind of like, you know, a vampire. I love his lab in this as well. It's like very gothic and
it's very Frankenstein, isn't it?
Yeah, again, very Frankensteinian and stuff. And I want that. That's the kind of stuff I like about him. And you are right. He is sometimes, he's not one of, even though he's a character who can hold his own and he's got multiple power sets, you know, stolen from different mutants over the years. He can be a force to be reckoned with, but he's not really that kind of character. He is one through kind of, is more of a puppet master and has a lot of you know, things going on and a lot of layers within layers and plans within plans. So I like he's more of a shadowy figure in this version. Like in the show, he was fine. You know, he was very much like a, they were like, you know, he looks like a vampire. He dresses like a vampire. You know, he's an evil dark scientist. I was never really a fan of the Nasty Boys in the show, which... Mm. That now in the 80s, he has a team called the Marauders who perpetrated the mutant massacre of the Morlocks in the tunnels. And it's later turned out that he, you know, someone, it was, I believe it was Sugar Man from the Age of Apocalypse had come into our reality, but further back in time, and was using techniques that he'd learned from the Sinister of that universe. And Sinister recognized his handprint or his fingerprint on that, like Beast talks about, his there's a fingerprint on the work that he does. And that's when he was like, well, this isn't my work, technically someone's stealing my patent on genetic modification, so I need you to kill all of these. And Gambit leads the Marauders to, we find out years later that Gambit leads them to that, the Morlock tunnels, to do that. And Sabretooth's in there, and Scalp Hunter, and Arc Light, and there's a few other characters I can't, Riptide's one, that perpetrate all that, Blockbuster, and a few others as well. I prefer kind of that team, and it's strange that they didn't use them in the animated series, but I think the Nasty Boys were very current at that time, but I think they're lame. I think they're so lame.
It's even the name, the Nasty Boys, you can't really take it seriously. I mean, there was a famous WWF tag team in the,
I was going to say, yeah,
called the fucking Nasty Boys. And that's who I think of when I think of the Nasty Boys. I don't think of, you know, this bunch.
Yeah, but no, got, but I'm, know, because one of them's like Hairbag, one of them's like called Ruckus.
Yeah.
And I was just like, this is just like, they're really struggling for like mutant names and ideas like at this point. I think the vocal performances are fine, apart from the Jamaican accent of Hairbag. I thought that was pretty dodgy.
Yeah, that's, you're going into cultural appropriation there, aren't
yeah,
you?
Yeah, a little bit. A little yeah. bit.
It's a bit Dan Aykroyd in Trading Places kind of thing. bit yeah. Lionel Joseph, yeah.
Yeah, maybe not. Maybe yeah, not. Maybe yeah. not. But yeah, I you know, yeah, it's not my favorite. But I like that he's more of a loner as a villain, Sinister. I like that idea that he doesn't need anybody, really. He's that powerful that he could, and he's that manipulative, and he's got wheels within wheels turning. I actually preferred it in a lot of the comics where he clones himself and there's just like multiple Sinisters talking to him, and the just the campy kind of sassiness to him as well. There's something there to him as well, which I really appreciate. But yeah, what did you think to all the kind of when Madeline Pryor comes into her own and starts, because she's kind of her powers are not demonic in any way. She's not imbued with sorceress abilities, magic. It is just a twisted, dark version that, and the kind of stylings of it kind of work with Sinister anyway. He was heavily linked in that storyline anyway, so it makes kind of sense. What did you think of that and the kind of almost the green energy as opposed to the blue?
No, I thought it worked really well, because when she does that, eventually does that transformation, when Sinister awakens the alternate persona inside of her, it helps to just mark her apart from the original Jane, doesn't it? You know, it just, if it was exactly the same, it would be like, well, it's the same person just with a different attitude. Yeah. I like the fact that they really tried to differentiate between the two, and it made her come across as a bit more evil as well, which, again, she's jumping ahead, but she's not really evil. She's been sort of manipulated into being this way, and you know, doesn't stay that way. But which to have her like that, I like it. Yeah.
Yeah, which is kind of like what happened to her in the comics. She's not out and out evil. Mm. She's just had some horrible shit happen to her, and you know, she never chose any of this. And I think in the show they do a really, it's a real sympathetic villain, unlike something like Executioner. It's a real sympathetic take, and even Magneto to a degree is quite a sympathetic take. But he always kind of was a sympathetic villain, as we talked about previously. But I like that she's you know, when they confront her and they're all very suspicious of her immediately. I will say, you know, they're like, we don't know when we were switched. That whole thing, like that Beast says, he knows how old she is. So
yeah, that's how he differentiates, isn't it?
Yeah, so surely he could work out, if he can tell when she was born as a clone, surely he can work out kind of roughly when they were switched.
I suppose so, yeah. I suppose you wouldn't know exactly what the time difference would be between her being created and being switched.
Yeah.
But at least you can sort of work within those parameters, can't you?
Yeah.
But I suppose they don't get the chance, I suppose.
Yeah, I mean, she throws it against the wall, doesn't she, the whatever, and then she doesn't want to be performed, you know, tests performed on her again, which they respect. So they go, yep, fair enough, we know you're a clone, but we won't push this. Because she's like, I'm still the mother to this child. You know, we're still in love. And Scott has quite a journey in this episode as well. And I love how kind of like the bond between the two genes kind of resolves it. It could have been like very much like, I'm the real gene, so you're shit, you don't exist, you're all fake, this is all fake, and you don't deserve this existence, you don't deserve a life. But it's not, because that's not Jean and that's not who she is. And she, again, helped her find herself again and learn who she was and remember who she was and the life she had. So I kind of like that sympathetic kind of sisterhood between the two characters, which could have easily just been like fractious, like fight, you know, for no need. But there's a lot of deep kind of emotional, you know, beats going on here for all the characters, really. Like, they all go through their own... you know, they all deal with their own failings or fears, or you know, they're confronted by that because Madeline Pryor, the Goblin Queen, gets in their head and brings that out in her kind of Dante's Inferno, let's call it.
Oh yeah, I mean, those scenes are just something completely wacky yet horrific, yet really intriguing, and poses a few questions as well about certain characters' motivations, which I guess is what we'll get into next. I mean, the visions are very sort of eclectic. You go from sort of Roberto Sunspot, his mother coming out of the television, a la The Ring, but in like this weird spider creature sort of voicing her disappointment. But then you get, which, you know, you kind of expect for him, but then you get some very sort of twisted and out there visions. I mean, the first one I want to touch on is the one where Gambit sees Magneto and Rogue sort of in a romantic twists. But before I mention that as well, I do want to point out as well, made me laugh as well, the fact that when they come out of the danger room earlier in the episode, they saw that Magneto and Rogue had booked out the fucking danger room for like every single day, just the two of them. And it's like, I wonder what they're up to in there, you know?
And morph. Now, I love that they're kind of already acknowledging it. Like the last episode, it was kind of like, oh, this is harsh, and this is like, it's going to be hard on Gambit. And now we're already kind of making jokes about it, which I kind of like. And I love where Morph is kind of going, because he plays a real integral part in this, because you know, there's references to him and being brought back to life by Sinister and manipulated, and what he does and who he is. And he knows where to find him. He knows where to go. But there's a real kind of trauma to him, but there's also a humor, which I really like, a cheeky kind of, you know, catty humor that Morph has, especially with that. And he keeps pressing it, and Gambit's like, it doesn't say those things, does it, Morph? And he's like, dee-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee, and it's just all the different sessions of Magneto and Rogue. And then he's like, right, I need to go find Rogue. And then Wolverine goes on, and he's like, I've got to find Jean. And like, one of the more interesting ones for me was the scene where, you know, Morph's left alone. He's like, and Morph's here alone again, because they're all going off to find their loved ones or potential partners. And Morph's like, oh, just me. And then he goes to get a shower, and then he finds Wolverine in there showering. And he's like, oh, hey, you know, and he's like, you know, he's like, oh, and then, you know, Wolverine showering naked. And he's like, oh, you know, he's like, oh, okay, yeah, we're showering like dudes or something. I can't remember what the joke he makes.
He says, do you want some help?
That was it.
Soaping those hard-to-reach places or something like that.
That was
very flirty dialogue. Yeah.
Yeah, very, very fun, very flirty and fun, but, you know, not too creepy. But then, like, Wolverine, like, or this version of Wolverine, this creation, this illusion, says, oh, you're all about the jokes. You act like I don't know, which kind of implies that there is... the friendship is, there's a bit more to it for Morph. And like, watching back like the previous second season of the original show, like Morph is always crying out for Wolverine or asking for Wolverine's help. He's always like, that's his focal point. And he even flirts with Wolverine as Jean, You know, if that's not if that's not like non-binary or wherever we fall on that spectrum with Morph, you know, what is? You know, he can become a woman, he can be a woman, he can act as a woman. And we see this in this show as well, because when Madeline Pryor takes over his mind, he becomes a female version of Morph, like his regular form. Because I mean effectively it looks like a male version, but you know what I mean. Like there's you know, he has lipstick on and the features are more feminine, but genuinely he's starting to really grow on me, this version of that character.
Yeah, I think it's very good. Yeah, and I like that they're playing with that sort of, you know, insinuation that he is romantically attached to Wolverine, you know. And it seems to be an unrequited attachment.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah,
I don't think Wolverine sort of feels the same way, but I like the fact that they're playing with that, you know, especially with Morph being essentially a non-binary character. That means that they can go in any direction you want to take the character. They can take on a female form, they can take on a male form and fall everywhere and everything in between. So no, I'm all for it. I think it's a really interesting, and I hope, it wasn't just a case of this episode was like that little bit and we'll not hear about it again. I hope they address it in later episodes. I hope Morph maybe opens up to Wolverine and says, you know, we're great friends, but, you know, I can't help but say, you know, I have these kind of feelings for you, and then see where Wolverine goes with that and how he processes it and how it affects their relationship. You know, it'd be quite interesting. I saw it would stir up a lot of people who are not happy with the X-Men and find it to be, you know, what it is. So I think it'd be great.
Well, I mean, the other week, after those episodes came out, people were complaining about Gambit's crop top. They were like, I was like, I literally did not even pass my mind. I was like, Gambit's in a crop top. It's the 90s. And people went absolutely insane over it. There was stuff going on. And there was also a framed picture of Xavier and Magneto. Magneto's got his arm over Xavier. And someone's saying, there's no way there's no heterosexual way that this would be appropriate. And I was like, I have full on kissed my straight male friends. Like I have intimately held my straight male friends. Yeah. You know, again, there's nothing wrong with being gay. The characters can be gay if you want them to be gay, or if you view them as that. Like they talk about being in love with each other, being close, and being inside each other's heads. You know, if you want to view it as a gay relationship, fine, that's fine. I've got no issue with that. I have a real issue with fucking bigots picking like a tiny thing of some soft, like minuscule things in an episode and going, super gay that, and it when it's not actually gay at all. And even if it was, it's fine. Get a fucking grip, honestly.
Exactly. Yeah. Ugh. They're just sat sort of stewing at home, stewing with impotent rage, basically. Yeah. So you know, fuck them. But then you know, their opinion is, when you start speaking like that, your opinion becomes completely invalid as far as I'm concerned.
Exactly.
So fuck them. Yeah. But yeah, that image of I sort of jumped off course there, but that image where Gambit sees Magneto and Rogue and they're sort of joined together. It's like something out of Society, you know, the film, the 80s Brian Usner film with Billy Warlock.
I was watching
it and thinking, Jesus Christ, that is literally like Society. And I was like, I will link
my podcast on Society in this, because that is exactly what I thought. That's immediately what I thought when I saw that. Interesting as well, that 80s cover of the Savage Land Rogue with her outfits all torn, and you know, and that's when her and Magneto kind of first hook up. That's the outfit she's wearing in that scene, which is interesting. So maybe they first did hook up while they were in the Savage Land. Maybe when Magneto is creating the mutates, before we see it in the second season of the show where Sinister's in control, maybe it's before she even joined the X-Men. Maybe she broke away from Mystique for a while and went off with Magneto or something. That'd be interesting to see.
Yeah, whether they expand on it, whether it was just a throwaway bit, you know, something in there for the fans, or whether they're going to expand upon it, because they're going to have to expand a bit more on the Rogue Magneto thing, because we've seen them, you know, last week we saw them have a little bit of a clinch and whatnot.
Yeah.
This week we discover they've been having trysts in the Danger Room on a regular basis, but we haven't seen either of the characters actually themselves address what they're doing and how it what it means to them or doesn't mean to them, and you know, what is it? Is it love? Is it, You know, is it just a physical thing for Rogue, the novelty of actually being able to be physical with somebody? What do they actually mean to each other? I'd be intrigued to see how they go with him.
I'd love to see like a really needy Magneto. Yeah. He's just like obsessed with it. He's like, Rogue, come on, please, love me. You know, I don't think that's how they would do it, but I think it would be quite humorous to see like if he actually does fall for her and she's like, and she longs for human touch and affection. You know, the idea of her becoming needy or, you know, possessive or obsessive about someone could happen, but it would be more interesting to see Magneto in that kind of frame of reference. But yeah, wherever it goes, I'm open to it. I'm fully on board and interested. Like that, for me, that's one of the most interesting parts of this show and the characters within it currently. But yeah, I'm really digging this. I think the animation in this episode is superb, especially the telekinetic magnetic battle between Madeline Pryor and Magneto. That is like top tier animation. Just that little sequence alone, like whoever the animator was on that, you know, take a bow, because that was incredible.
Oh, I agree. It was very cinematic, wasn't it? You know, you wouldn't see that out of place in a, you know, a multi-million dollar action blockbuster. It was great stuff, because you got to see both characters and what they can do when they fully let loose, you know. Really, really good stuff. And I don't know if it was just my ears playing tricks on me, but during that particular exchange when Magneto's in full flight pulling the metal frame of the stained glass window off the wall and using it as a weapon, the musical score in the background became identical to, you know, in X-Men, X-Men First Class, you know, the scene where they're in the bar in Argentina and he's confronting the old Nazis who were part of things in the concentration camps.
Yeah.
And he, you know, he's there with the three of them in that bar and he says, I'm Frankenstein's monster and, you know, I'm here to do whatever. And he does that very cool moment where he telekinetically fires the gun on, magnetically fires a gun on one, and what that scene, you know the one I mean,
yeah.
You're very famous with Fassbender. Yeah. The score in that was almost identical. Now I don't know if that's deliberate or it's just coincidence or whether my ears are just, you know, my age and my ears playing tricks on me. But if you get a chance, go back and listen and compare the two. The scene itself is on YouTube. It's a very famous scene in X-Men. But I just thought that was a really nice little homage to sort of the power of Magneto. Again, and maybe I was just imagining it, but I wrote that down as I was listening to it. I'm just looking back at my notes here, and I just think, wow, that's a really cool, you know, I like little references like that. It's, you know, it's like how they always have to sort of have elements of the John Williams Superman score whenever Superman does anything in future incarnations of Superman.
Yeah, it's always a little slither of it, yeah.
Here and there, you know, Snyder did it, you know, in Justice League and it was the Justice League that did it. I beg your pardon, any Snyder fans out there.
How dare
you, Max? Don't come for me.
How dare you?
I know, yeah, that's terrible, isn't it? I am a Snyder fan myself as well, so slap on the wrist for me. But yeah, you know what I mean. It's that in that context. But yeah, that is a great, sorry, I've gone off track there again, but that is a great face-off, isn't it? And we also get a little cameo treat of, unless I completely read it wrong, but of Morph changing into magic.
Yes,
very
Ilyana
as well.
Yeah, again, I covered her kind of origin story kind of in when I was doing Wizard Month. You'll remember Wizard Month for Spider-Down and the Secret Balls. I covered that. And that is kind of where these kind of the seeds for Inferno, the entire crossover, were planted. So go and listen to that. Go read that. Really good miniseries. Really solid. Love that character. Really interesting. I quite liked her in the New Mutants movie as well. Anna Taylor-Joy, I thought it was really good. Really
underrated film.
Yeah, I kind of like it, you know. There's a lot worse X-Men movies out there than that, I think. But this is kind of a continuity error, though, because she never joined the X-Men and she never got her demonic powers and she never became a teenager. She was always a child. We saw her. She was referenced when we first met Colossus fighting Juggernaut, because he was like, I need to find my sister in America. And wonderful accents they had in this show. My friend Sarah, she's been messaging me and saying how bad some of the... I was talking about the episode where Externally Yours, which is the Gambit episode, his backstory and the The TAV, I've got to do this for the TAV. And I was just like, yeah, it's just awful, awful Cajun accents. And she's been watching the Proteus episode. She's Scottish herself. So she's like, these accents are fucking atrocious. And I'm
The 90s, Moira MacTaggert in the animated show. Jesus Christ.
I didn't even know, Charles. I didn't even know what's going on. What can we do? It's bloody, bloody awful. But again, I kind of forgive it. So technically, you know, we did meet her in the second series where he's fighting Omega Red. She makes an appearance there. But she never donned an X-Men uniform. It's one of those. Again, I forgive it, but it's another niggle to my growing list of niggles. But again, minor as it can be. I'm glad she was referenced because, again, in Inferno, she plays a huge part in the New Mutants angle of that and the ending of that story. And I talk about it in that podcast again. I'm really glad there was a little nod there. And even in because he turns into her in her New Mutants outfit, and then he turned into the Dark Child persona, her demonic persona as well, which I really enjoyed.
Yeah. Well, I think what's cool about this is you can get now via Morph being able to turn into these characters and use their abilities. You can cameo so many characters now without them actually being in it. Mm. Like in the first episode, we got Angel, didn't we? We got Lady Deathstrike, for God's sake. We got
Colossus
Psylocke
as well. Yeah.
Yeah. And now we're getting Magic. So you can literally have any character who has no business being in that particular episode. Yeah.
No context for it.
Yeah, no actual reason for them to be there. They're not involved, but they can literally just pop in for a minute by virtue of Morph turning into them. So the possibilities now in this show for cameos from anyone within the X-Men or even wider Marvel Universe pretty much unlimited because now we've got this vessel for them. It's great.
Yeah, I really like that. And I like when he turned into Spiral and he's like, yeah, we're going to call her Jean Doe. Let everyone raise their hands. Which I thought was a really cool. Again, Spiral's like a very obviously she was in the animated series and she played a role, but she's kind of a deep cut character really for most kind of X-Men fans, I think. But yeah, I thought that was a fun little nod and stuff. What else do we want to talk about with this episode? There's so much to kind of go over. I don't even know where to begin or to end.
There's the stuff that comes after, isn't there, where you learn when they've managed to rescue Nathan, which is quite disturbing, actually, of seeing the baby in this sort of the vat, and you think, Jesus, that's not nice at all. You know, this poor innocent, you know, babe. But when you learn, obviously, what his plan was and how they've kind of semi-ruined it, actually, by intervening before he could, he come to its fruition. So they've left him in this vulnerable state with that techno organic virus that now has.
I can't believe you said babe, and I've not realized that she's called the Goblin Queen. So I'm thinking of Labyrinth and Jareth and reminding me of the babe.
Dance magic dance, yeah.
I mean that would have been something Morph should have turned into. That would have been a cool little joke if she said, I'm the Goblin Queen, and he goes, oh, I know a Goblin King, and like turns into David Bowie, you know, or something
summer
like that.
Baby. Yeah.
Well, that would be
I'd pay really good money to say that. Yeah.
Yeah. They probably couldn't get the rights, or there was they couldn't get Bowie's likeness, or they couldn't get the rights for Labyrinth or something. But that would have been me in the writer's room suggesting that. But that's just me, I guess.
No, that's a shame. Maybe Bowie's wife didn't sign off on it. What a bitch. Yeah. You know, that would have been really great. But never mind, you know,
one silly joke some writer tried to make one time, not even at David Bowie's expense.
I know, so precious, some people, but there you go. But Bowie aside,
yes.
It is very cool, actually, the way they see the child infected and it growing on his skin. And then there's this heartbreaking, well, it's their only option, basically, isn't it? That they're going to have to give up this child now, who they've literally, it was literally only born in the I don't know how much time has passed. He's got quite a big baby, actually. So I don't know how much time is supposed to have passed between.
Well, he's going to grow into a very big man, Max. So he's got to be big straight away, hasn't he? Surely. That's mutant bigness, mutant buffness. That's what it'll be.
Yeah. maybe he ages a bit quicker or something. I don't know. But
I mean, we know his genetics are like superhuman, the best genetics of all time. So that's probably why. But he seems to be like, he doesn't cry that much. He's pretty okay with most stuff, apart from going in the green goo.
But he's a tolerant baby actor, isn't he? Yeah.
All the shouting and screaming, all the demonic entities that are attacking the X-Men. This is fine. Totally fine. I'm cool with this.
There was a really nice
nod as well, which I liked, to the techno-organic virus. In the comics, it is Apocalypse that infects Nathan, and a woman called Ascani comes, and she's part of a religious group in the future, which is actually led by Rachel Summers, and they rescue Nathan and try and save him in the future, as opposed to Bishop in this. But it makes sense to me. It makes sense that it is Bishop. It makes sense that it is Sinister. But the effect of the techno-organic virus is a callback to the episode I talked about, Time Fugitives, with X-Men, the animated series version of the Legacy virus, which was an allegory for AIDS. And mutants were being blamed because it was linked to mutants and only affected mutants until it started affecting humans. And again, that's where the allegory kind of works. So yeah, I really like that nod, because that is a Cable-centric episode and one of his best, I think. So I like that little kind of touch there, because I was like, I wonder how they're going to show it without having show it. Is he going to grow the metal arm like he did? Is it going to overtake his body or something? But yeah, no, I love that little nod, because again, I was like, I know what that is. I remember that. So yeah, wonderful little, again, fan service for people who pay attention and watch and care about that original show.
It is cool. It's a very nice little reference. But I like what you get before they send him into back to the future, I should say, with Bishop, is you get this wonderful exchange where she's like, oh, I don't want my baby to feel abandoned. I don't want him to feel like we didn't want him. I mean, they're only doing this because they literally have to do it to save his life. If they don't, he's going to die. So there's no option here.
Yeah.
But the way she's kind of psychically gives him, not memories as such, but like a sense, like a mental sense to know that his parents didn't abandon him, that they literally couldn't, because they're not allowed to go with him either. That's the thing. Is Cable's, Bishop's wristband. He says it. It only has enough juice for me and the baby, doesn't it? That's what he says.
Yeah.
So that immediately that's your plot device for them not being able to go to and stay in the present. So she sort of psychically imbues him with this overwhelming sense of parental love, and that, you know, it's kind of like the speech Jor-El gives to before he sends away, like, you'll carry us with you all of your days and all this, you know, you are our future, you carry our light inside of you, all that kind of stuff. It's kind of very reminiscent of that, and I think it's really quite touching, actually, you know, for a cartoon that's been very action-packed and scary, with horror elements. You get this moment now which boils down to like a mother's, you know,
love,
unconditional love for a child, and the way they send him on with love, that's quite a nice touch, isn't it?
Yeah, I have to agree. It was like Scott goes absolutely, like, he's devastated by this whole idea. He can't be a part of it, and he's like, I was an orphan, I was abandoned, which is not kind of true, but I know obviously he has deep trauma affected with it. You know, his parents assumed they were dead, they died, because they could see again, I talked about Cyclops' origin on the previous episode, but their parachute catches fire as they're falling. So that was them. And then they get kind of beamed up to a Shi'ar ship, and become, you know, slaves to the Shi'ar. But that's kind of how it works. But again, I guess it's kind of like the Xavier, he's not really dead, but he is dead kind of thing. But I think it's really affecting. It's really heartbreaking that he has to, not only has he lost, he believes he's lost the love of his life, he's also lost his child in the same episode. And now he has this complete stranger, technically, but not a stranger, that he now, like that, you know, what really hit home for me was that scene where Jean walks into the room and it's just them stood there together. I was like, really, like, it felt like really heavy on my chest, like how emotionally powerful that was. I was like, almost
left hanging as well, isn't it? There's no conclusion to that scene. The scene ends with them stood staring at each other in the room, isn't it?
Yeah.
And then it cuts to the end.
Yeah.
Sort of and tease, which we'll get to, but the tease, we'll move forward together. You don't know what next week their relationship's going to be, do you?
I have a feeling that I love the scene where Wolverine is there trying to console her because she doesn't know who she is.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
She doesn't know how to control her powers. She's losing her mind. She doesn't remember who she is or what she can do. And Wolverine's there as a constant. And he's like, look at me, focus on me, think of me, read my mind, let us know, find who you are through me, like via me. And I think that, again, that's a really powerful scene because this is Wolverine's life. She's experienced what Wolverine's been through, experimented on, and had his memories taken away and messed and had fake memories implanted. You know, I have a feeling, this is, again, more speculation from me. You know, I love a good speculate. I think that because of this kind of, let's say, schism between Scott and Jean now, because they kind of don't know where they really stand in their relationship, I think she might, because she's gone through this trauma and she relates to it and she can see that Logan cares about and loves her so deeply and he's gone through and he can relate, I think this version of Jean and Wolverine might hook up, I think.
Yeah, maybe. I think the seeds are there, aren't they? I mean, you know, obviously we know how Wolverine feels about her. You know, you only have to think back to how he spent their wedding day. You know, rather than attending the service, he was killing versions of Scott in the danger room, wasn't he? I love that bastard.
I'd love you that. Know. He's in a tuxedo, like destroying Sentinel.
He's supposed to be a fucking groomsman, and he's there in the danger room, murdering artificial versions of Scott.
Bit problematic or obsessive, or it's weird. It's definitely weird, but I kind of love it as well. Like, that is kind of what he would do, version of the character anyway. Like, he would go that far and put himself to, you know, because it's the only way he can kind of, you know, exercise those demons, so to speak. But I really like that scene. I thought it was really nice and really telling. And I also love that we see Jean's kind of origin story as well, which is something I think we learn for the first time during the Inferno. I think what it is Madeline Pryor remembers that moment in her life. But then she goes, that's not my life. My name is not Jean. You know, because what happens, they don't really imply it too much here. But as this young girl, her friend dies and is hit by the car, Jean is with her inside her mind and she feels her die. It while she's inside her mind, which was traumatic and painful for her. But it's really, really fascinating, a wonderful thing in her own origin story, in her own history as well, that I think before Inferno we didn't know about. I don't think they'd gone into her kind of backstory that much at that point. It's a wonderful little thing. And just to kind of hint at that, I was like, oh yeah, I remember this. You know, I remember I know what you're referencing again, you clever bastards. I thought that was another wonderful kind of touching moment. And again, she never says, like, your feelings are not valid, your emotions are not valid, your love is not valid, you are not a valid person, you are a fake person. She Jean, for lack of a better word, is the heart of the team, the empathic one. She's Dana Troy, or whatever her name is in Star Trek.
Deanna Troy,
that's the one. I knew I'd get it somewhere. I can remember Madeline Pryor, but I can't remember Deanna Troy. And that she, even this person who's trying to kill her friends, her Scott, Wolverine, everybody, she still is open and welcoming and will put herself at risk, yet defend herself when needs be, to save the lives of everyone. And she isn't even there as well. Like, she uses her powers to project herself there as opposed to being there physically, which is also interesting as well. Like, and it is very on brand for Jean and that, and what she does and what she brings to the X-Men as well.
Yeah. It is. It's cool. She accepts. She says, "You are me." Basically, we are kind of one and the same. We have exactly the same memories, although we haven't lived the same life. One of us has been there at the expense of her. In our heads, we've lived the same life, so there's no prejudice that way. And then it's telling when sort of Madeline decides to, you know, for when she's seen the light, so to speak, at the end, and is no longer being controlled and decides to go and forge her own path. Jean says to her, well, I'll see you around, Jean. And then she goes, no, you know, my name's Madeline Pryor.
Yeah.
But the fact that she still calls her Jean before that just shows that she doesn't view her any differently. It's a nice touch, you know. And I don't think we've seen the last of her. I think, you know.
No.
She'll be back in some way, shape, or form. Even if it's not in this series, maybe she won't be, and we'll just focus on this Jean trying to reacclimb. Like you've just said, will she hook up with Wolverine?
Mm.
Will her and Scott be able to build bridges and get back to how it was before? I don't know. Maybe we'll just focus on that. But at some point, Madeline Pryor will come back to the show. There's no question.
There'll be some form of her will come back. I think what you talked about last week, I think we looked at the episode titles, and one of them is Remember It. And they use the word remember a lot in this. And again, while Nathan has been handed over to Bishop, and Bishop also references somebody that is in the, you know, not after credits tease, but the end of the episode tease for the next one. I know a guy who can create anything in the future. Oh, do you now? Yeah. Who could that possibly be? Mm. And I like that. But yeah, so she's talking about remember, and Madeline Pryor is talking about how powerful memories are, and memories are what make you who you are, which is kind of an insult to the Jean who can't remember herself, the real Jean, the Jean Doe, that they called. So I don't know if maybe remember it might be we might see what, because I think everyone will want to know what happens to the baby, because I think the audience in general, people don't want not to know what happens to that poor baby. They want to know that he survives. They want to know where he goes. We know where he goes and what and who he becomes, but how does he get there, and how do we get that fully formed character from what we have here, which will be really interesting as well. And I'm very interested to see where this next episode takes us as well, with that last minute tease for these characters that are going to interact in the next episode.
Well, we called it last week. We said you don't take Storm off the board in that way. You don't strip her of the powers and then have her go off on her own and then sideline her for long. I mean, Christ, literally the next episode, isn't it? We learn that she meets a certain somebody in a bar who alludes to the fact that a depowered status might not be as permanent as we've been led to believe. Or maybe it is, but this certain person says there's a way that they can restore what she once had, so to speak. How and why they will do that, how they will do that, remains to be seen. But it's certainly an intriguing concept for next week, isn't it?
Definitely. There's again, they're referencing a very well known storyline, but again, I'm sure we'll get into that next week. And I think I might even be a two parter, maybe. I'm not sure. I can't remember. But yeah,
I think it is. Yeah.
Yeah, I think we'll see a bit more. I don't want to kind of talk about that too much until next week. We've got Tonya Todd is definitely joining us next week, so I've confirmed that, so she's going to join us for that episode, so that's going to be really, really good. But unfortunately, we were going to have a guest, but it didn't quite work out, Max. So Rhea Carrigan was going to join us, however she has written in, and I'm going to read her thoughts on this episode, if you'll indulge me.
Oh yes.
So I will just find that on my phone. Where did I put it? Excellent podcasting content here. Where did I put it? I've lost it. Completely lost it. No, here it is.
Should we sing a song?
We should sing a song. Dance, magic, dance. Dance, magic, dance. Okay, here we go. So, sorry I can't be there. Gutted I can't make it, especially as this episode... with its horror influences, as this episode has its horror influences. It is the perfect episode for me to talk about. Before I share my thoughts about this particular episode, I just wanted to say that after hearing the theme song for the first time after all these years, gave me chills. So epic. Like most millennials, the X-Men cartoon was such a huge part of my childhood, and just the opening bars of the theme song made me so happy. And I know you've covered it already, but I'm so impressed with how they have launched the series and made it accessible for everyone. You don't need any knowledge of comics or previous series to be able to enjoy and to understand the stories they are telling. 10 out of 10. Right, on to the episode. Here's my rambling, so I'll try to keep them short. Firstly, I would like us all to appreciate how unhinged Cyclops is, and I am here for it. Dude had some serious PTSD, and I don't mean for that to sound dismissive, because it isn't. I appreciate how they are telling his story in a very limited amount of time. The moment that really stands out for me in the episode is when Cyclops is yelling at all the X-Men that they don't understand what it feels like to be abandoned. To the X-Men. Each and every one has been abandoned at one point or another, but poor Scott is so blinded by his own trauma and not processing it that he can't see anything outside of that. I'm looking forward to seeing how the show explores the impact of Madeline Pryor and Jean Grey fallout. As a fan of the comics, I have an idea and predictions, and I'm really excited to see how the show will approach it. I adored the horror elements of this episode. It's a mashup of horror's greatest hits and tropes. The Gene clone has been binge-watching the Horror Channel. But for all the horror elements, it is the emotional arcs of all the characters that carry this episode. From Gambit, beautiful, sexy Gambit, and the rogue Magneto booking out the Danger Room, real subtle guys, and the gooey body horror vision of them together. The brief glimpse we get of our weather goddess Storm to the major impact of Madeline, Jean, Cyclops, and Nathan's story arc, and the heartbreak for each of those characters. The brilliance of the first two episodes is that they brought depth to our mutant heroes for all the revelations in this episode. We have real emotional connection to them. It allows this episode to push the story forward without the viewer feeling left behind, because we are on the journey with them. It is rewarding for both superfans and newcomers. These stories are character-driven. It does not rely on extensive knowledge, which there is absolutely nothing wrong with, but is something that is quite frankly irritating these days, especially with other Disney franchises. X-Men 97 allows the viewer to connect with the characters and enjoy the stories without having to be lore bores. It's a really solid episode. Sure, it could have been a two-parter, but I'm not going to complain. This show is bloody excellent, and I'm just going to be happy that it's here, and it is damn good. Also, the most real thing that happens in this episode is Jean waking up, realizing she needs to sort everything out, tying her hair back, the universal sign that a woman is about to kick butt and sort everyone's shit out.
And that, very good stuff, yeah.
Yeah, that is Rhea Kerrigan's thoughts, and I have to agree with the majority of those, I think, if not all of it. Wonderful, wonderful stuff. I'm really glad she took the time to write that. I know she couldn't have been here, and I'm sure she would have put it in a much more succinct way than I did reading all that. But yeah, no, that was really, really good. Thank you, Rhea. It's a real shame you couldn't be here with us. I was really looking forward to it, but I'm glad you did take the time to do that. Yeah. But yeah, wonderful.
It was great. Really good. What we should have done is just read that out, and then people wouldn't have had to listen to us waffling for an hour.
Exactly.
And she summed up everything that we mentioned in the past hour. So next time she can write that and we'll have a week off.
Yeah, we'll just do it. We'll just chill. We'll just put it on record. You know, yeah. We'll just leave it. But it's like when I am Jack's musings and we're doing Back to the Filmography and he brings up Lou Shoemaker. He reads the review and I'm like, fuck's sake, he said everything we've said in a paragraph. We've spent 2 hours trying to say it, hour and a half trying to say it. Yeah. Standard stuff. But yeah. I do have one comment from Sarah Coyne, I mentioned earlier. She basically said this episode should have been a two-parter, and I can't disagree with her. I kind of think maybe it would have helped, but also I don't know if the kind of overarching story that they're trying to tell would allow them to do that, and maybe in hindsight, maybe they would or could have stretched that out a bit more. Or maybe there is, like we said, maybe there is going to be a second part to it, technically. But we'll have to see. But I think that's a very valid criticism of this episode, I think. I liked it. I don't know if I liked it as much as the previous episodes we've seen, but I still really enjoyed it.
Yeah, I think the quality over the three episodes has been really consistently high, hasn't it? I think in some ways it's a case of after the Lord Mayor show, where the first two were so good that it's whatever you put out as episode three is going to be really, you know, really, really hard act to follow. Yeah. So it's going to suffer via comparison. It's like Predator 2 after Predator, isn't it? You know, once some candy, but it's still, it is still a marvelous film on its own merits. It's just following on from...
I will also link that podcast in the show notes as well.
Please do. Please do. But you know what I mean? The bar's been set so high.
Yeah.
Even if you shoot just below that bar, you're still knocking it out of the park.
I would say if the first two episodes are a 10, this is like 9.5.
Oh, easy. Easy.
Again, very minor problems I have with any of this. Again, it's continuity stuff mostly, or, you know, the odd thing here and there. Like Bishop's time band kind of being is working in a completely different way that it used to. Like, instead of him, again, they haven't really explained that, but now it seems to just be the device that sends him back in time, as opposed to, you know, keeps him at this time. It's the kind of working in the opposite way. I don't know if they'll bother explaining that. I think maybe they'll just leave it.
Explain why he was here in the first place either.
Yeah, kind of. I'd like to know maybe a bit more. I don't know if maybe that will tie into maybe a time travel episode with Cable again and Bishop. I don't know. You know, fingers crossed we get a bit more of that. But yeah, no, I'm very excited to see where the next episode takes us. I think next episode again might be a bit more fun, but also I think it might be a bit more serious as well. Somewhere down, I think they'll try and find a middle ground for the next episode after the kind of dark, because it's almost like the first episode like built the X-Men up like, this is the X-Men, this is them at their peak, this is them at their zenith, they're most powerful, and then each subsequent episode is just stripping them down and breaking them down. But that, again, that's going to lead... This is the arc that they're building. They're, you know, Scott's in bits, Jean's in bits, Storm's in bits. Like, we're going to have the rise. We've got to have the fall before we have the rise. So it's part of that. They know what they're doing. You know, all the people that were complaining they stripped Storm of her powers, they know what they're doing. They're not doing that just for the sake of it. They're not just going, just take her powers away, willy-nilly. There is a reason for this. And again, if this, you know, episode... this arc is going to work, and I think it is working massively already. I think, like, when we get to that finale, all of these pieces are going to fit together wonderfully and give us something completely unique.
Yeah, I couldn't say it better myself. I think they're doing a masterful job so far, you know, and also, even now that we're still speculating about what might happen, who we might see, they're really keeping the cards close to the chest, which I like, you know. So we still don't know what the overall sort of arching story of this
again. This is all we don't know
who the ultimate villain is. It's all guesswork.
Exactly. Like, we don't, like, we know, like, again, like, there's been hints and clues and things, and again, they're pulling from a lot of the Chris Claremont stuff, which I've read and I remember. So that's why it's, you know, I go, oh yeah, there's this, and I remember that, or maybe they'll play with this, and maybe they'll do this idea, or maybe they'll switch it up. Again, it is all speculation. We do not know. Again, we've seen some vague synopses, we've seen the titles, but other than that, we literally don't know. You know, the clips and the articles come out usually on the same day the episode is released, you know, or maybe the clip is the day before or something, or maybe a sizzle reel or a trailer, but that's all we know. Like, again, you know, I think I've undiagnosed ADHD, which is something about, there is something within that brain that it has pattern recognition. And I think that's something I'm quite good at. And like with stories, like I can predict where the stories are going and things. And again, I have foreknowledge of comic book storylines. They're no doubt inspired by and using and, you know, cherry picking stuff from. So that's probably why I can somewhat predict to a degree, but again, I have no idea where it's heading, but I'm here for the journey.
Oh, me too. And what a journey it's been so far. And we're only 3 out of 10 down. So
we are not
even halfway yet, but we've seemed to have covered so much ground in those three. You're really getting value for money. This isn't meandering storytelling. This is like as much bang for your buck as you can get in 32 minutes.
This is the reason I got back on Disney Plus. Like, there was no, you know, the reason I got on Netflix was Daredevil. The reason I got back on this was X-Men 97, you know? So yeah. And I'm here for it. And you know, take my money, take it all, give me all of this, put it in my veins. But yes, I think we're done, unless we've got anything else to say. I don't know.
Oh, no, I think we've covered all the points we want to cover. We've had the great, you know, great feedback there from Rhea as well, which is fantastic. And yeah, I just can't wait for next week to see, you know, it's one of those, whilst it's great that it's a weekly thing, at the same time you think, oh, I really want to watch the next one, but now I've got to wait a whole week. You know, it's like, it is literally like living in the 90s, you know, this sort of arrangement. But
episode
4.
I'm glad, you know, that this is the format. You know, I didn't mind the binging format. I probably am more of a binger, but I think if the show is this good, I don't mind the wait.
I don't. And it gives everyone something to talk about in the week leading up, isn't it?
You, me, and Dave Horrocks with an X have been chatting and talking about, you know, we're just reinvigorated by the whole franchise and everything. We're talking about storylines and what they could do or what they're talking about and stuff. And again, he's going to take my place for a couple of episodes while I'm away, and he'll be a wonderful co-host, and he's allowing us this platform to talk about X-Men. And I can't thank him enough. It's his birthday today as well. So happy birthday.
It is.
So I just want to say thank you. Thank you for allowing us to do this and letting us just whittle on about mutants and all sorts of other weird shit that we've talked about in this episode. thank you. Thank you very much. But that's it from us. And we will see you next time on Examining X-Men 97. Check you later.
Bye. Doodle 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 dood